Hello, welcome to The Restless History, continuing our epic World Cup themed sweep through 32 countries of the world that have qualified for the Football World Cup in Qatar. And today, Dominic, we come to, I would guess, the country that probably has the least history. Or at least the least history
that perhaps people
in this country have heard of any country. And that is Costa Rica.
Come on, Tom. You're not a favourite Costa Rican history?
I mean, this
is unbelievable.
Costa Rica is famous for its wildlife, isn't it?
It is indeed.
It's famous for its red-eyed tree frogs.
Right.
It's famous for its tremendous programme of reforestation.
Yeah. It's a great ecotourism destination.
It is. Tom. And of course, it's famous for its dinosaurs.
Well, I don't know much about Costa Rican dinosaurs.
Well, you do. You do. It's best known tourist attraction, Jurassic Park Isla Nublar.
Very good. Very good.
I know nothing about it.
Well, Tom, I tell you what, to make it accessible for you. Now, I know we said from the very beginning of this World Cup series that it absolutely wasn't going to be about football. But we will start with a tiny bit of football, just a tiny bit, I promise. So the 2014 World Cup, which was held in Brazil, Group D, England were drawn in Group D, and they were drawn along with Italy, Uruguay, and Costa Rica. So a tough group, three former winners, England, Italy, and Uruguay. And a lot of people in England said, well, this will be really hard, but at least we'll get 3 points against the Costa Ricans. Tom, do you know who finished top of that group?
Costa Rica.
They did. And do you know who finished bottom?
England.
England. Absolutely right. Now, the thing is, we should have known better than to underestimate the Costa Ricans, because that was actually their fourth World Cup and they have qualified for six. And that World Cup in 2014, they went on to reach the quarterfinals and they came within a penalty shootout of reaching the semifinals. Extraordinary accomplishment for such a small Central American country. And actually, when you step back from that and you look at it, Costa Rica, as I said, is in Central America, and their neighbors, so Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Panama, none of them have had anything like the same kind of sporting success that Costa Rica have had. And generally, as you probably know, Tom, in sport, as in so much else, it's actually money and stability.
Yes, and Costa Rica is a very stable country, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. So when you look at that list of countries, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, many of those countries are some of the most violent countries in the world. Higher homicide rates, higher imprisonment rates than anywhere else. They're politically very, historically very unstable, and they're also extremely poor. But if you look at any ranking in Latin America, Costa Rica is not merely the safest country in Central America. So, as you said, an extremely popular ecotourism destination where you can be pretty confident that you won't get into any trouble. But it's one of the most affluent countries in Latin America. So it's comparable only really with Uruguay, Chile, and Argentina. So the countries right in the south. Now, when you look at it superficially, there's no obvious reason why that should be the case. Because in Costa Rica, they have the same Spanish language, they have the same customs, they have the same kind of ethnicity as people do in Nicaragua and Honduras and so on. So what is the explanation? Why is Costa Rica such an outlier? And to answer that, Tom, do you know where we need to go back to?
No, I literally know nothing about the history of Costa Rica. I cannot put into words how little I know about the history of Costa Rica, because I know nothing, literally nothing.
I'll be frank with you. You're going to be educated. You don't even need to educate yourself, because I will do it.
Thank you.
We are going back to the Costa Rican Civil War of the 1940s. Very exciting topic.
Wow.
So,
okay. Who knew that they'd had a civil war? I suppose the Costa Ricans do. But not many people
were distracted by other stuff that was going on in the 1940s, yes. I suppose, foolishly. Yes. And their eyes were not on Costa Rica, where the main action was happening. So, okay, let's pull the camera right back. If you're in Costa Rica in the 1940s, where are you? So at the bottom end of Central America, you've got Nicaragua to the north, you've got Panama to the south. And historically, this has been the backwater of backwaters. So before the Spanish came to the Americas, there were obviously people in Costa Rica, pre-Columbian people, but there weren't, you know, great empires and cities as there were in what are now Mexico and Peru. The Spanish called it the Costa Rica, the kind of the rich coast, basically from hope rather than anything else. They hoped there would be gold there.
So like Greenland, the Vikings calling it Greenland.
Exactly.
Right. Marketing scam.
They hope there's gold and there's a tiny bit of gold, but there's not very much. And it takes them ages to conquer it. They basically don't conquer it for about 50 years. Almost all the indigenous people are wiped out through disease. And after that, basically, I mean, to cut a very long story short, nothing ever really happens in Costa Rica. It's very underpopulated. There's no native labor. So there's no point establishing a big kind of hacienda, the big kind of estates that people establish in much of Latin America. It's very poor. It's very sparsely populated. It's kind of peasants. Even the governor, the Spanish colonial governor, has to basically farm his own crops and even kind of look after his own garden because there aren't enough domestic servants and laborers and things to do it for him. And as you no doubt know, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, much of what's New Spain breaks away from Madrid. And so Costa Rica becomes independent, kind of despite itself. And it goes from one entity to another. It's part of the Mexican Empire. It's part of what's called the Federal Republic of Central America. At one point, some American adventurers even tried to take it over and fail. But it ends up as this kind of independent republic. And in the 19th century, the big thing that happens is coffee. So in the 1820s, the coffee trade really takes off. And actually, the biggest customer is Britain. So they start an Anglo-Costa Rican bank for coffee growers. They build a railway from the coffee estates to the coast.
Presumably, is when the deforestation happens.
Yeah, exactly.
They're now busy repairing.
Yes, absolutely. But even so, Costa Rica is still very underpopulated. No big cities, no big estates. There's not much to fight over. And so although it's there's a bit of turbulence in its politics, they're nothing like as turbulent as in Latin American countries where there's a lot of tension between big mercantile cities and kind of agricultural magnates, between kind of liberals and conservatives, blancos and colorados, all that stuff that you get in the 19th century. The other thing about Costa Rica in the 19th century, before we get back to 1940, we often completely forget this in English-speaking world. Latin America was often very progressive. So they abolished the death penalty in 1871. They had freedom of religion. They had separation of church and state and the separation of kind of the judiciary and the legislature and the executive. So they're quite forward-thinking. And their politics is not ideological. It's all about patrons and bosses, big bosses, which makes it very confusing. So that's all the sort of context. Now, 1940. So the president at the turn of the 1940s is a bloke called Rafael Angel Calderon. And he is a doctor. He's been educated, interestingly, in Belgium. So almost everybody in this story that we're going to meet has kind of European links somewhere or other. And he had come into, he'd become president as the sort of the friend of the coffee oligarchs, as they're known. So the people who control the coffee estates.
A coffee oligarch.
Yeah, you could be a coffee
oligarch. What a thing
oligarch.
To be. Yeah.
There's a lot of money in coffee. But over time, like a lot of Latin American politicians in the same period, he becomes more and more populist. And he sort of carries out welfare policies and
but he doesn't start wearing epaulettes or
caps
or anything, any of that stuff.
He doesn't. He doesn't quite go that far. Now, in Costa Rica, there's a constitutional provision that you can't run for consecutive terms as president. So Mr. Calderon, Senor Calderon, can't run again. And he gets basically a sort of dog's body of his.
So this is kind of Putin behavior.
Yeah, Putin and Medvedev.
Like Medvedev.
He gets a dog's body of his called Teodoro Picardo Michalski to succeed him.
Michalski?
Now, Mr. Picardo Michalski, his mother is from Krakow in Poland.
Right.
And he, very impressively, Tom, he speaks English, Polish, and French, as well as some Russian, Italian, and German. I mean, who knew that Costa Rican politicians were such
polyglots?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does he speak any American?
Any Spanish.
Any Spanish? No, any American languages, kind of.
Native American languages.
Yes.
Kind of like Nahuatl or something.
Yes.
No. No one speaks that in Costa Rica, so it'd be pointless for him to speak.
Right, okay.
Unless he was like a sort of J.R.R. Tolkien figure learning it in his attic.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, he doesn't. But you know what he is? He's a historian.
Is he? I'm on his side.
Well, are you though? Because
I don't know.
Like a lot of historians, he's a bit of a weed. He's a sort of placid, weak figure, Mr. Picardo Michalski. Now, as we get further into the 1940s, Costa Rica starts to become a little bit unstable because basically the populist policies that Senor Calderon, the doctor, was promoting, and then his sort of flunky Picardo is they provoke great unrest among the kind of professional classes and the coffee people and so on. And as is so often the way in Latin America, they become increasingly kind of authoritarian to kind of defend those policies. And they basically start to rely more and more on militias provided by the Communist Party. So you've got this kind of growing tension, sort of violence on the streets and so on, and the stakes are getting higher and higher. And of course, the Cold War is in full swing by the late 1940s. So there's just a sense, you know, the temperature is rising. In 1947, there is a general strike called the Huelga de Brazos Caídos, the Strike of Fallen Arms. I don't know why it's called that, but anyway, there's a sort of, there's a general strike, and the government is very cross about this and starts intimidating merchants and manufacturers and so on. So there's a real sense of pressure. And what really adds to this is that I said there were term limits. It's preventing consecutive terms. But Calderon, like Vladimir Putin, I suppose.
Can that come back?
It can come back in the next election in 1948.
And what's the weedy historian making of this?
He's just going to step aside in okay. weedy historian fashion, I suppose.
Yeah.
I know you're disappointed by this,
Tom. I am disappointed. I mean,
would you do this? Maybe you would.
No. No, I wouldn't. I would learn the lesson of history and strike, and I'd strike hard.
Okay, well, he didn't.
Dominic, that's what history teaches.
It does. I've told you many times, the lesson of history is eat your neighbors before they eat you. That's the lesson of history. Anyway, listen, Calderon is going to run again. And everybody knows this, and everybody knows he's desperate to win. And his opponents, who are the sort of conservative middle classes and so on, and the people who are worried that he's too authoritarian, they put up as their candidate a newspaperman called Otilio Ulate Blanco. And everyone knows it's going to be very close and contentious. And as in the lead up to election day, on the 8th of February, 1948, there are all kinds of dark rumors that there's going to be fraud and there's going to be ballot stuffing and all this. The result is announced. And the newspaper bloke, Ulate Blanco, has won 55% of the vote, and Calderon has won 45. So the big man, the populist, who everyone thought was going to be the quasi-dictator, has actually lost.
Like and Tom, Alex Salmond in the Scottish independence referendum.
That wasn't the analogy that I was going to look for, because he takes the stage and he says, this is the mainstream media, fake news.
Well, very Alex Salmond.
I haven't lost at all. There's been all kinds of fraud in this election. I warned about it beforehand, and I'm not going to accept the results. And mysteriously, the day after the election, a suspicious fire destroys a lot of the ballots.
So quite Trump.
Exactly. Tom, finally, yes, that's what I've been, I mean, I've probably been very hard on Calderon here, but I thought, you know, why not? So a fire destroys a lot of the ballots. So Congress, which is controlled by Calderon supporters, cancels the elections 3 weeks later, throws them out. Mm-hmm. And Picardo, the weedy historian, says he'll carry on as president for the time being until they
decide
what to do.
Well, that's not weedy.
No, well, he's doing what he's told. He's doing what is told by Calderon. So there's absolute outrage at this, Tom. Complete outrage. And Ulate, the newspaperman, is outraged. He says, I've had the election stolen from me. And he's going around. He goes to his friend.
But what's the point in being a newspaperman if you can't?
Well, his newspaper's obviously denouncing this.
Yes, of course. I mean, fake news.
Well, I think the Costa Rican Civil War is definitive proof that people who think their mainstream media control politics are wrong. Tom.
Right. Okay.
Anyway, this newspaper bloke, he goes to his friend Dr. Valverde. I don't know anything about him, so I can't provide any form of pen portrait. Let your imaginations do the work with Dr. Valverde.
He has a little pencil moustache and faintly sinister kind of Nazi glasses. And he does experiments on amphibians for fun.
But ultimately, I think a kindly man, Tom, a family man.
No. He's the embodiment of evil.
No. That's not how I imagine Dr. Valverde.
Is he goody? Yeah.
You've got the sides completely muddled up.
Oh, I know nothing about this. I'm just
you
going.
You don't know who the good guys are. You're out of your depth, Tom. You don't know who the good guys are in this story at all.
Okay,
Dr. Valverde is very kind to children, gives sweets to the homeless.
Okay.
He's a great man. He's a
all right.
But this is a dark day for Dr. Valverde, because Dr. Valverde, Tom, is hosting. Do you remember who Otilio Ulate Blanco was?
Yes, he's the newspaperman.
Yeah, he's hosting him at
a
meeting.
He's been robbed.
Yeah, he's been robbed of the election. Otilio Ulate Blanco has gone to meet Dr. Valverde.
Right.
But what's the significance of that?
The police surround Dr. Valverde's house, Tom.
Because they know he's evil.
Shots ring out, and Dr. Valverde is shot in his own doorway. And Ulate Blanco escapes, but is later...
Maybe it was for the best.
...captured. No, not for the best. So this is a sign that the Calderonistas are determined to do anything in their power to retain control of Costa Rica, Tom.
Right.
But they have reckoned, do you know who they've reckoned without? A figure we've not yet mentioned, but the greatest figure in Costa Rica's history.
John Hammond.
What?
John Hammond.
Is that your suggestion? John Hammond. Who's John Hammond?
He sets up Jurassic Park.
No, it's not him. They have reckoned without Don Pepe himself. Jose Figueres Ferrer, a name, Tom, to conjure with.
Echo down the ages.
In the world of Costa Rican, Costa Rican historiography.
So tell me about him. Do we know about him?
I think he is such a big figure, and he is the father of modern Costa Rica. We should absolutely take a break to compose ourselves and come back after the break to talk about Don Pepe.
Okay. Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History, where we are talking about the Costa Rican Civil War, a subject I know literally nothing about. But Dominic, you know lots about it, and you are building up to perhaps the most exciting moment in this already, I have to say, thrill-filled episode. And you are you're introducing Mr. Big, Senor Grande, yeah. Don Pepe,
Jose Figueres. The big man of Costa Rican history, Tom. So I told you before the break, if you were listening, as I hope you were, that all the people in this story had European connections. And this is certainly true of Don Pepe. His parents were from Barcelona, and he'd been born in Costa Rica in 1906, just after they emigrated to Costa Rica. And his Catalan identity was always very important to him. He's very independent-minded. Is Figueres.
Like the Catalans tend to be.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's why he sort of says, I'm Catalan. I'm always very Catalan. I'm very strong-willed. He's sent to a seminary. Doesn't like it at all. He drops out in the 1920s, and he goes off to Boston to study at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But he's studying hydroelectric science at MIT, and he finds it, unsurprisingly, I think it's fair to say, very boring.
Yeah.
So he drops out of that as well, and he puts himself through a curriculum he's devised himself of reading at the Boston Public Library. And he reads Cervantes, he reads Kant, he reads Nietzsche, and he reads H.G. Wells. So he's a clever man. He comes back to Costa Rica. He becomes a big coffee grower, and you will delight you to hear, Tom, he is a manufacturer of rope, which I know your reading of Patrick O'Brien, you're very interested in him.
Okay, I'm against him.
So he is a philanthropist. He's a very kindly kind of Victorian paternalist employer. He builds houses for his workers.
Okay, now maybe I'm not against him then.
Yeah, exactly. You were harsh on Dr. Valverde.
Yes, I was.
Who's now dead. And you cannot afford to be harsh on Don Pepe.
Okay, I'm all for Don Pepe.
He establishes a nice vegetable farm for his workers.
Oh, FIFA Don Pepe.
A dairy with free milk. So what's not to like? He's a great fellow. Anyway, he's a kindly man, I think it's fair to say, to his sort of workers. But in the early 1940s, he had become increasingly alarmed by the authoritarian direction of the Calderon administration. And he had, in fact, been exiled for 2 years in Mexico because he'd said, this sort of authoritarian president is going to end up as a communist and you should watch out. He comes home. And in the run-up to that election, he had become a major figure in something called the Caribbean Legion. And the Caribbean Legion is a kind of pro-democracy group across the Caribbean. They're very opposed to the dictator Somoza in Nicaragua and Rafael Trujillo, the horrible dictator in the Dominican Republic. And one of their members, Tom, who you'll definitely have heard of, and we won't need to provide an invented pen portrait of, is a young man called Fidel Castro.
Okay.
He's a member of the Caribbean Legion. So the Caribbean Legion think, basically, if we can have Costa Rica as a democratic base in Central America, then we can spread democracy to the rest of Central America. And Figueres, Don Pepe, is very keen on this. And when he hears about the murder of Dr. Valverde, not as you claim an experimenter on frock, but a kindly
gentleman.
Well, I think it's fair, more accurate to say, a man of whom we know absolutely, you and I know absolutely nothing.
But Dominic, maybe we have some, who knows, perhaps some Costa Rican listeners. And if we do, or we have anybody who knows anything about Costa Rican history, they could tell us.
Yeah. I can assure you, I have scoured what few books there are on Costa Rican history, and I can find nothing about Dr. Valverde.
Okay. Wow.
Anyway, listen. Figueres decides, this is my chance, basically.
Figueres is Don Pepe, just to be clear.
It's Don Pepe, clear. Yes. Yeah. I'll call him Figueres from that throughout. Let's put Don Pepe because he sounds too much like a pizza or something.
He sounds like a brand of sherry, doesn't he?
He does. He's actually not a pizza at all. That would be Italian. He's a brand of sherry. He's not. He's Figueres. He's a very impressive person. Figueres says, right, this is it. We're going to have to trigger an uprising the election has been stolen and all this stuff. And he's raised this little army. And it's a really weird kind of ragbag of anti-communists, of people who represent the coffee interests, but also people on the left who are, you know, they're left-wing, but they're pro-democracy and they're suspicious of the kind of the authoritarianism of the Calderon regime. So this little National Liberation Army, it fights its way into the second city within a couple of weeks. So the fighting sort of breaks out in March 1948, and by the 12th of April, they're in Carthago, which is the second largest city. They're kind of carrying all before
them.
So
Carthage?
Yeah, named after Carthage.
And so this is really becoming quite a theme of our
Carthaginian
World Cup episodes, isn't it? We've had Dido, we've had Ganabal, and now...
So maybe when the World Cup is over, we can repackage this series, Tom, as a...
Yes.
The world history of Carthage
around the world, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, the support for the government is melting away, and they're increasingly reliant on the communist, on this communist militias. So the capital is San Jose, and the communists are kind of holed up in the capital. And the question is, are they going to hold out while Figueres' little army are approaching, or are they going to accept defeat? And it's at this point that the United States is really crucial because, of course, this is the Cold War. The Americans are very, very anti-communist. And the Americans basically make it plain to the government. They say, if the communists end up properly taking over, we will send in troops from Panama. So they mobilize. They have troops on alert in the canal zone in Panama ready to step in. And Picardo, the weedy historian, who's still president.
Oh, he's still there, is he?
He's still hanging around. He's a bit of a figurehead. He sends a message to Calderon and to the communists, and he says, listen, it will be an absolute catastrophe if we have street fighting in the capital.
Because as a historian, he would know that, wouldn't he? That would be a lesson of history that he would draw. And if he hadn't been a historian, yes, he could have said street fighting and be brilliant.
So this is a victory in some ways for history. It's a vindication of history.
I think it is.
So, and he says, basically, the United States will step in and this will be a disaster. We can't have this. So the Picardo, the communists and Calderon, they all agree they will give up.
Okay.
Calderon goes off to Nicaragua with Picardo, the historian. So the doctor and the historian are gone. The communists just sort of melt away after a bit of fighting. On the 24th of April, so, you know, what is it? What are we, less than 2 months after the whole business began? Figueres' forces enter San Jose and they take over the government. So not big death toll, about 2,000 people.
Is that
the war lasted 44 days. Well, wait for it. So just to tell you what happened to all the characters. Picardo, the historian, he stayed in Nicaragua forever. He never came back. That was the end of him. Calderon, the doctor, he's in exile in Mexico, where he just goes back to being a doctor again. Then he comes back to Costa Rica. He runs for president unsuccessfully and ends up as an ambassador to Mexico from Costa Rica, which is quite a sort of, that's quite a benevolent outcome. Now, that is a clue about what happens to Costa Rica. Because actually, everything that we've talked about till now is sort of standard Latin American stuff, isn't it? Coups and
communists.
People called Don Pepe and all that sort of thing. But what actually happened, it's what happens that is the difference. What happens now? Because Figueres, he takes power for 18 months and he's basically says, I will take power and then I'll give it up. I have no ambition to be a dictator. This is the guy we talked about as the Catalan who read Cervantes and was the sort of kindly rope employer. And in his 18 months, he gives women the vote. He abolishes the sort of reading requirements, you know, the literacy requirement for voting. He confirms the existing welfare legislation. He nationalizes the banks. He writes a new constitution. He expands public education. He gives citizenship to the children of black immigrants, which had previously been denied them. And but he does one thing above all for which Costa Rica really is famous. He abolishes the army.
Costa
Rica is still the only country of its size with no army. And why does Figueres do it? Well, he basically, he knows that the army is sort of untrustworthy, I suppose. He's frightened maybe of a coup, so, and he knows that the army was working for his adversaries. But also there's a kind of idealism there. He basically says, if you don't have an army, then you won't have more coups and you won't have civil wars. And he's also, crucially, I talked about his reading in the Boston Public Library in H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, in his book, The Outline of History, had predicted a future with no armies. And he had said, a world with no army, a sort of pacifist world, will be a better one. Figueres genuinely believes it.
And that is a kind of much nobler way to not have an army than Qatar, that we talked about in our first episode, which also doesn't have an army. So there's a parallel. And then does he give up power?
So he gives up power. He literally walks away.
So he's like Sulla. Roman dictator, but obviously less bloodthirsty.
Sulla kept coming back, didn't he?
No, Sulla laid down his dictatorial powers and then went off and died of intestinal worms. But I mean, he killed a lot of people, but it sounds like Don Pepe
didn't kill anybody.
No, he's a much more benevolent figure.
He walked away and then just became a democratic politician. So he actually had two more terms as president.
What an admirable man.
In the 1950s and 1970s. He had such an interesting sort of political identity. He was always close to the United States because, of course, he studied in Boston.
Yeah, reading all that stuff in the library.
He was very careful. So he would sort of criticize them in public and in private, saying, he used to say, your hands are not clean to fight communism if you don't also fight dictatorships. And he's not wrong. He took money from the CIA and the KGB. Interestingly.
So he's not only,
he's canny.
Not only a benevolent man, but a canny man,
He's a canny man. When, in the 70s, when he's quite an old man and president again, some Nicaraguans hijacked a plane in San Jose in 1971. And when Figueres heard about it, he went straight, he was 5'3", so very short. He went straight to the airport himself with a submachine gun and pointed it at the hijackers in the cabin until they surrendered. So he's a brave man.
So he's benevolent, he's canny, and he's a have-a-go hero.
He is.
He sounds one of the most remarkable political leaders of the late 20th century.
Apparently he went to a Central American summit where he was held in low regard by other Central American strongmen for all of this behavior. And he went, and at a Central American summit in 1973, he said, ruined the atmosphere, apparently by his own description. He spoiled it for them all by saying to them, isn't it odd that all you bastards are generals and I'm the only civilian, but I'm the only one who's ever fought and won a war.
He sounds great. I love him. I love him. And to say it again, the thing I'm loving about this series is learning about all kinds of things I knew nothing about. I think he is, Dominic, I think he's my favorite 20th century South American leader. Well, Central American leader.
I think he is proof that political choices genuinely make a difference to countries' destinies. Because if you look at Costa Rica right now, it has the lowest crime, the highest literacy, the best healthcare, the greatest stability, and indeed the best football team in Central America.
And the best frogs.
And the best frogs. And it's still, of course,
despite the efforts of the evil Dr. Valverde.
Poor old Dr. Valverde. I like to think that you'll get angry letters from his descendants, Tom, about your shameful. But I'll tell you, that, I'll end with this. Do you know what they did with the army? Do you know what happened? Of course you don't, because you've said yourself you don't know about Costa Rican history. So they had a public ceremony when they abolished it in 1949. And they had a public ceremony. And the commander-in-chief in public took the key to the army headquarters and he handed it to the Minister of Education, who announced that it would henceforth become a museum.
Wow.
And it still is.
Swords beaten into school textbooks.
Exactly. So there is Costa Rican history.
Amazing, Dominic. Wonderful. I honestly thought this was going to be probably the most boring episode, but I completely apologize. That was a brilliant episode. So thank you very much.
I think the highlight of that was your discussion of poor old Dr. Valve.
Well, I hope that that everyone else listening enjoyed that as much as I did. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more World Cup-related historical shenanigans tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Adios.